I will call this January the 16th, 2003 meeting of the Revenue Committee to order and welcome everybody today. Our Honorable Chairman is not with us this morning, and it's my pleasure to chair the committee. We have an interesting day today. Paul is going to be giving us an orientation overview, and I know that we all look forward to getting up to speed as we start off on learning about what our responsibilities are going to be on this committee. What I'd like to just set a few ground rules, and that is that Paul will be down doing some of his PowerPoint presentation, and he is open to questions as he goes along. And so in order for this to be very free-flowing, if you'll just ask to be recognized by Paul and then ask your question, and we can just continue on so that it doesn't take such a long time. So, Paul, okay. Welcome. And
thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of things before I get started on the material is I did come in this morning, and I had a phone message at 4 a.m. from our chair, and he was on his way to the airport and was thinking of some things for us to do on that trip there. So he's apparently on his way. The schedule for next week we will have in your offices by the end of the day today. Essentially, what we're going to do is continue our orientation. The focus today will be very much on the current situation and give you a sense of what we see happening with the general fund, what has happened, talk very broadly about the revenue system. Some of the material, those of you who are new to the legislature, some of the material we had talked about at our orientation of a couple months ago. Then next week we will begin to go through our major issue areas, starting with the personal income tax, going to the property tax, then the excise taxes, with a focus really on cigarette tax, and then Thursday to look at school finance, give you an overview on school finance, and then on Friday we will have the revenue options, school funding, and accountability task force will be ready for release, and it will be released to this committee next Friday morning. So, and we're working on getting some of the advisory council members, Governor Attia's advisory council here to talk with you about their interpretations of the work of the task force. The other thing that I would mention is that, as you recall, the chair recommended that if you've got some issues that you'd like to see on the work plan, to go ahead and get that information to us, and we will make any modifications and have a final work plan for you early next week. So if I may, Madam Chair, I'll head down and...
Absolutely.
I have made a copy and the notebook form with the three slides per page for you. So this is the material I'll go through. So you'll have that available for notes. We want to put our orientation material on the website for those that might be interested in downloading the actual charts and graphs. And if you have some further use of this information, just let us know and we can give it to you in the form you need.
Paul, I just want to point out to those folks over in that corner, if I look like I'm staring at you, it's actually the screen behind you. I'm not making googly eyes. I just want you to know that.
Sure you're not. What I want to focus on today is the current revenue situation. Talk a bit about from a historical perspective, to talk through some of the issues of the 1990s that we're still very much living with, and what the implications of that are for Oregon's public finance system. Talk about what's happened over the last 2 years
kind of the revenue crunch we've gone through, and then talk about what we see lying ahead for the 2003-2005 period, and what kind of risks are out there, and emphasize that the forecast and the revenue projections you're working with and the governor's recommended budget are a base case, a middle-of-the-road case. And as we've seen over the last 2 years, certainly things can turn out to be worse than are assumed in our forecast. So I think that's become a lot more a message for policymakers, is we have to recognize that conditions can deteriorate very quickly. In terms of the 1990s, of course, Measure 5, passed in November of 1990. And as we mentioned yesterday, there were five previous attempts at limiting property taxes over the prior 15 years. And so Measure 5 was the first successful effort to do that. The legislature had enacted a number of measures to try to relieve the property tax burden in the state. This was really the focus of the 1979 legislature, for example. There was a series of major revenue bills that came out of that session. One was the kicker. Another was a spending limit. But a third one was property tax relief, and there was which amounted to a large portion of the general fund going into the 1980s. Well, with the pressure on the budget in the 1980s, that PTR program, property tax relief program, was phased out, essentially eliminated by the late 80s. So you didn't see necessarily a sharp jump in property taxes in the 80s, but what you saw was a sharp increase in property tax after adjustment for property tax relief from the state. When that relief went away, then that net property tax burden went up. And that was clearly one of the factors that helped push Measure 5 over the limit and over the 50% majority. But Measure 5 had a series of implications for the state. One of the most critical ones, of course, was the centralization of our finance system, and you're living with the consequences of that. It also led to a search for alternative revenues, and we'll look and see kind of in a big picture sense what happened, how the state and local governments responded. And the other characterization of that period that no one anticipated, certainly I didn't at the time, was the strength of the economic boom, including the financial bubble in the 1990s that really kind of distorted our view of what the underlying forces were in our public finance system. This is, I think, the best description of how the public finance system changed in the 1990s. For the first time in our history, beginning in the 94-95 period, our income tax collections exceeded our property tax collections. So that was the first time that had happened. And that, of course, then you think the level of government here, very clearly the centralization that's implied by this graph. Now you have the state government with the largest source of revenue, as opposed to local governments and school districts receiving property tax dollars directly. A lot of people certainly were disappointed in the property tax relief that came from Measure 5. I'm sure you recall that a lot of people that felt they were going to get some reduction in the property tax, but because of growing assessed values for residential property, they either broke even or in many cases actually saw a net increase. We had several years in the early 90s where residential property statewide increased 12%. So there was a very strong growth. This was true in many regions, Central Oregon, certainly in the metro area, on the coast. So a very widespread increase in residential property values. But despite that trend, and remember that Measure 5 was a rate limit that did nothing to do with value. It was a rate limit only. So it limited property tax rates. And during that period, if you go to 1990 and look at the average property taxes in the state, they were about 2.8%, or $28 per thousand statewide. What Measure 5 did was push that limit down to $15 per thousand, or 1.5%. So basically cut the rate in half. So as the rate was being reduced, property values were growing, But if you look at just raw collections here from the time of passage of Measure 5 until the rate was finally lowered on schools to $5 per thousand in 95-96, property tax collections fell 12%. So Measure 5 reduced overall property tax collection 12%, predominantly schools, because the Measure 5 limit, and we'll go through the details with you on this in the property tax section, but Measure 5 limited schools to $5 per thousand, everything else to $10 per thousand. So during this period, we had a reduction in collections. And then notice what happened as soon as Measure 5 reached its limit of $15 per thousand. First year, we still had strong value growth going on, and collections rose actually about the 12% that they had fallen the previous 5 years. So in 1 year, they jumped 12%. Those property tax bills arrived in people's mailboxes in October, late October of 1996, and they had Measure 47 on the ballot. So Measure 47 passed with a similar majority as Measure 50, and that, of course, promised relief from value growth, not just rate relief, but value growth relief. And it also rolled back property taxes, and you can see, again, the effect here is they're rolling back. There's about a 2% reduction in dollar terms here. And then as we look out ahead, we think that the underlying growth rate here on property taxes is about 5% per year. And one of the things that we'll be monitoring for you is the how property tax collections are coming in for schools, because remember, property taxes are still a third of school operating budgets statewide. For example, value growth last year, which would be based on the change in value from January 101 to January 102, grew at 4.1% statewide. So there was some slower growth. Multnomah County, for example, only grew 1.5%. As you can clearly see, some effects from the recession, but you can also see the relative stability of the property tax. In a recession, we get slower growth, but we don't get outright declines.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, quick question.
Sure.
Do I detect a difference in the trend line between property taxes and the income tax?
Yes.
So that the property tax is actually increasing more slowly?
Yes, Representative Barnhart, the property tax underlying growth rate is about 5%. We think the income tax is really 6.5%. Is an underlying trend. And of course, you can see the volatility has come through very clearly here in the last year. And also, this is running here about 10% per year during the boom 1990s. So, yes, that clearly shows what economists call the different elasticity of the two measures, which is a measure of stability. Property tax far more stable than the personal income tax. And the property tax under the Measure 50 system is even more stable than it was prior to that. One thing I would emphasize, though, if we do, and you never know how the environment will change, if you think back to the 1970s and the inflation rates we saw in the 70s, if we were to return to something like that, then the property tax would not respond. It would still go up 3% a year, even if inflation was 10%. So that would be put a real financial stress on property tax-dependent local government.
Madam Chair? Paul, generality here. How does the increase in property tax, how does that curve compare to the increase in population?
Our population is growing in the neighborhood of 1.5% per year. What we use kind of as the base assumption for economic growth in the state is about 6%. And that, of course, is dependent on the underlying inflation rate. The underlying inflation rate is in the 2.5% to 3% neighborhood. And we've been in that range for quite some time. So if we stay in that inflation range, we think that the overall economy, as measured by gross state product or by personal income, will grow about 6% a year. And we think property tax values will grow slightly less than that. Now, there is still some voter discretion on this property tax line because, remember, it's dependent on local elections, on bond measure levies and so forth. And we have seen some years in which it's popped above the 5% since the passage of Measure 50.
Gotcha. So a follow-up to Representative Farr's question. From the 3% growth of existing homes to the 4.1 that you said this year on property taxes, the 1.1 differential is the true net growth of properties coming on stream?
Representative Scott, the 4.1% is the value growth, assessed value growth. It is affected by exception value and new construction being the largest component. There are some other things like subdivisions and so forth that can be a part of that, but it's primarily the new construction. We think the underlying growth rate there is probably about 2%. And that's, we do the kind of the back of the envelope is 3% existing property, 2% new construction, 5% total.
And this year, though, it was the 1.1.
This year, it was 4.1 total or 1.1. Yes. But keep in mind, too, that we do have properties, particularly business properties, such as personal property, that are not governed by Measure 50, they're because they're valued at market value. Measure 5 is still a limit out there. So if the value of that property, and of course we have seen this in the case of commercial and industrial property during the recession, if the value of that property is the market value is lower than what the maximum assessed value would be, it's the market value that prevails. So you can actually have declining values for existing assets, and we've seen that. Things like food processing facilities in the valley here, we've seen some major revaluations because of the recession, because of the income generating capacity of those of that capital.
And those are through appeals, though.
We've seen some through appeals, but also in terms of just general market trends. The other side of the coin here is the income tax, and the income tax growth rate you can see here is running almost 10%, which is remarkable in a period of 2.5 to 3% inflation. So we were getting 6 to 7% real growth in personal income tax collection. That was unprecedented for us. We've had fast growth before, but it always occurred during periods of rapid inflation. Also keep in mind that during this period, there was no change in policy that increased this revenue flow. The legislature didn't increase the tax base. We did see some minor changes through Federal ReConnect, for example, that expanded the base, but pretty minor. In fact, the bigger policy things that slowed this growth rate was the 2% surplus kicker, because there was always unanticipated revenue with the rapid growth we saw. That would tend to return the next biennium because it was a permanent reduction in the base. But what was a permanent reduction in the base was pulling out federal pension income, which was a result of court decisions, which was a rapidly growing component of the income base. So you can see very rapid growth in here, and then we'll look in a lot more detail at what's happened here. This is this huge drop of going from the peak here of 2000-2001 and dropping during the 2001-2002, the last fiscal year that we had completed. And we'll talk about this assumption about coming back to the long-term trend. Now, one of the things that I think is helpful to get kind of a big picture of things is to look at the census data. And I think some of you have seen this. And what this does is it gives us an all-encompassing measure of revenue, and it also gives us an easy comparator with other states, because while we could say there's gray areas in some of the census definitions, at least we know it's consistent across all the states. We do, by the way, prior to Christmas, about a week before Christmas, we got the 99-2000 data from the census. So we've updated some of this, and some of these numbers are a little different than what you've seen in the past. Well, if you look at the revenue numbers here, and you can see how the revenue system has changed since Measure 5 passed, and you can also get a sense for that, my earlier slide about the search for alternative revenue. This is the alternative revenue, and you can see it in this chart. If you look at taxes in 89-90, Oregon, in this general revenue mix, 54% of the general revenue was taxes. Again, this is general revenue as a census defines it, not as we do, but as a census does. And general revenue, according to the census, is all revenue received by state and local governments, with the exception of trust fund revenue. So it would include the public employee retirement system, the workers' compensation trust fund. So any trust fund kind of revenue is not included here because it's not for general purposes. It's not really for delivery of public services. It can be a cost, but it's not for delivery of public services. And the other thing that's not included here is government enterprises, which would be, for us, it would include OLCC. But in terms of government enterprises, we're about average. If you look at the taxes, though, taxes are imposed on the residents of the state or the businesses of the state, and you can see that the amount of revenue we received in 89-90, 54% of our total general collections, are about where the country is now at 57%. So if you kind of look down this list here 10 years ago, it's pretty similar to where the country's averages are today. But what's happened in the wake of Measure 5 is the taxes as a source of general revenue fell dramatically in Oregon. So that now we are much less dependent on taxes than the average state and local system. Remember, this has local governments in there as well.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
And Paul, we've become more dependent. Would the number one thing we've become more dependent on be the lottery? I mean, is that the primary shifter of those numbers?
Well, if you look at the numbers here, and you can see the two things that really jump out here are federal and charges. Lottery is a factor down below. Lottery is in miscellaneous. And miscellaneous, the biggest chunk of miscellaneous is interest income. And, of course, interest income over this 10-year period went down because interest rates went way down. So if you look at most states were up around where we were here in terms of 13% or so back in 89-90. But, see, we haven't fallen much. The reason is the lottery. Mm. We are more dependent on the lottery as a revenue source than any other state is.
Mm-hmm.
Not on gaming, because Nevada has the gross receipts tax, but on lottery as a state-operated revenue source. But if you look at the big numbers, where the revenue has come from, the federal number really stands out. And clearly, I think that this is, and if you talk to the people that have developed the budgets over this decade, there has been an aggressive effort to leverage federal dollars. And you can see it in these numbers. The other thing is on charges at the state level, things like tuition, for example, various fees particularly for business services, and also at the local level, for system development charges and other kind of charges for local services. So you have seen a shift toward use of charges as a funding source.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at our general revenue and compare us with other states, you can see that our general revenue is quite high compared to other states. We're actually ranked ninth among the states at 23% of our personal income. And this is why the question that we're often asked is, how can we be a high-spending state and be a low-tax state? Well, the difference is we rely on these non-tax revenue sources. Now, there's a couple of things to keep in mind about these numbers as we look at them. It's true that we just got them about a month ago, but also look at the year here, 99-2000, as in peak of the cyclical boom, particularly peak of the financial bubble. And we're going to see these numbers change over the next couple of years. The number that we're going to see change the most is this personal income tax number as a percent of income. The reason for that is that by this income definition doesn't include capital gains. It's not It's not personal income by the measure that's used by the national income accounts. But the tax dollars that come from that capital gains shows up under taxes. So it's in the numerator, but not in the denominator. So you're going to get a higher tax burden the more income tax dependent you are, which, of course, we're at the head of the class in that area. So, but if you go down and look at these sources, our tax burden is about 10.5% of personal income. This is all taxes, state and local. The average state system is about 11.2. So in terms of tax burden, we rank 39th. And actually the prior year, and a number probably many of you have seen, we ranked 45th as a tax burden.
Paul, you and I chatted about this actually yesterday, and it would be helpful, again, I think, at least for me, to have you explain why we would have been 45th in 99 and 39th in 2000. Can you explain to me what would have caused that shift?
Well, there are two things that caused us. This our tax burden actually went up from 10 to 10.5% over the 2 years. One of the things that has always caused a lot of fluctuations in our tax burden is the kicker. Because the kicker is a one-year refund. Our tax burden goes down and then goes back up again when the next year when you don't have a kicker refund. So 99-2000 does... those swings can be affected there. But I think what's really influenced these numbers are, the 99-2000 is the cyclical peak. So we're picking up those capital gains revenues here, and that's pushing up our personal income tax burden, at least as it's measured here, temporarily, because when those capital gains are gone, as they now are, you're not going to be collecting taxes on them. The second thing is we did see a jump in corporate revenue. And corporate revenue is very volatile, and we did see a significant jump during that 99-2000 period. Again, not because of any change in policy, but because of the performance of a very small number of major taxpayers. And those same taxpayers have gone the other direction in the last 2 years.
So given our current cycle, I know that these numbers lag by 1 to 2 years by the time you get the census data, but coming off of the peak on our ability to tax those or get revenue from those capital gains sort of into the trough that we're in now, how would you expect that number to adjust? So if we could get up to the moment data on where that number is, what would you anticipate it would be?
I think that the capital gains piece alone... and we're finding there are the boom influenced our revenue in more subtle ways than we were aware of. But the capital gains piece alone adds about 0.3 to that tax number, percent of income. So that would knock it down to 10.2 alone.
Mm-hmm. And that would adjust our ranking.
That would knock us back down closer to where we were. It knock us back down probably to 44th or so. 44, 45.
Okay.
And if you incorporate the other factors that have pushed our income tax down, we have been impacted far more than the average state in this downturn because of its effects on the income tax. So there's no question our relative tax burden has fallen during this period. Of course, the other thing that stands out about Oregon's revenue system is the unique combination of taxes. We often hear Oregon is a high tax state. Well, that certainly is the case if you're looking at personal income tax. We are the second highest tax burden in the nation as a percentage of income. New York is number one. Corporate, we do tend to be around the average. Actually, the prior year we ranked 27th here, and we dropped to 18th. Again, that was because of a surge here of a corporate revenue in that period. Our consumption tax burden, and this sales tax measure does include so-called selective sales taxes like cigarette, gasoline. And even when you compare us with the other four states that don't have a general retail sales tax, we still have the lowest consumption tax burden. So in other words, Montana, Alaska, New Hampshire, and Delaware that don't have a sales tax still have a higher consumption tax burden than we do. And we rank 50th. Also notice the difference here. This is about 4%, and this is about 2.7%. Actually, the retail sales component here is about 2.5%, pretty close to what personal income taxes are on average for all the states. So the other 1.5% of that 4 is the selective part, the excise tax. And property, the biggest change here is we have dropped below the average in terms of burden, and we dropped right as the median state now with this new data on property taxes. So we went from rank number 5 in 89-90 in property tax burden prior to Measure 5 to now number 25. So we've gone from a high property tax state to an average property tax state. That is a consequence of Measure 5 and 50.
Madam Chair, could I ask one more?
Sure. Representative Barnhart.
And based on the trend line we talked about a little bit ago, this is likely to continue down, isn't it? In the comparison with other states.
In terms of the property tax or in terms of the overall burden?
In terms of the rank of Oregon with other states on property tax.
Well, on property tax, I suspect it will. But keep in mind that other states have a lot of pressures on property taxes, too. Property taxes are generally an unpopular source of revenue, and there's been a long-term trend to try to find some other revenue sources, particularly for local governments and for schools. So that trend is still continuing. We're not going to see the big hits that we saw in the 90s because we've phased down to Measure 5. So it could be we could stay near where we are now.
Okay.
The mid-rank. Keep in mind the southern states in particular have a real averse reaction to property taxes. They don't like them, and they have relatively low property taxes, most southern states.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Farr.
Almost speculatively here. We hear a lot of people say that Oregon's corporate income tax is 0.5% compared to personal at 4.6%. That a lot of folks feel there's a disparity there. You don't need to answer this now because I'm sure you don't have the numbers in your head. I'd like to know what the personal income dollar amount versus corporate income dollar amount is, so that you know, when people ask me that question, I can respond somewhat intelligently.
Okay. The Representative Farr, the dollar amounts are in your public finance packet, and I can't remember the page, but I can show you that right after the meeting where those are. There's a page showing fiscal year corporate personal and property tax revenue for the last 30 years.
Thank you.
So that's a good way to go. But also, of course, keep in mind when we talk about a corporate income tax, we are taxing not business in the sense that we normally think of business. We're taxing a particular form of business, the corporate structure. We receive about 10 to 12% of our personal income tax revenue is really business taxes through subchapter S, through proprietorships, through partnerships. So and we do keep track of that. We have some data on that as well in your tax packet. Our tax burden is something that our OTIM, Oregon Tax Incidence Model, produces. It allows us to distribute both the, of course, the individual tax burden, but the business tax burden through the economic assumptions that OTIM makes in terms of price, impact on prices of taxes, impact on wages, impact on returns to capital. So we're able to distribute the tax burden, and because we have such an income tax-dominated system, you can see that we have what amounts to basically a regressive component here due to the property tax and a progressive tail out here due to the personal income tax. But overall, the system is pretty flat, pretty proportional, meaning that the tax burden is about the same for all the income classes. The percentage of taxes that are paid is about the same. This is a little bit higher percentage than my 10.5 because it's a different definition of income here.
What are the lines?
The this over here is effective tax rate is taxes divided by income. So it's at 12% would be the tax burden for this lowest income group our lowest group here is less than 9,000. Then we have 9 to 29,000, 29 to 49, and so on. Our top group is about 109,000 and above.
Yeah. What I'm asking about are the vertical lines that are in the middle of the graph. What are those?
These are just to try to break out these income groups. So you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. These are breaking out those income groups. So if you look at it, it looks like you've got a lot more people out here than you do here, but these are just income groups. We've just broken them into income groups for purposes of looking at what the tax rate is for each of those groups. And it just happens the top group, of course, covers a much wider range. But this can become an important issue for you if you do look at modifications to the system. You'll see property tax relief for low-income proposals, and what our analysis shows is you do get a regressive component here due to the property tax, due to renters paying the property tax or higher rents, seniors in particular paying higher property tax because they tend to have a high home ownership rate but low current income, and consumers through commercial property taxes on what we call the domestic sector, which would be restaurants and retailers and so forth that are competing with one another within the local economy and not exporting.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, Representative Barnhart raises an important point. Where is our mean income? Where would it fall on that line? Where would the bulk of our taxpayers fall on that line? Give us a rough. Just the range.
In terms of your basic tax packet, those numbers are in there, and right in that beginning section.
Okay.
It shows you the number of households in each of those categories. The median does depend on how you define.
Exactly. That's why I'm just saying.
Household median's right, a little over 40,000.
Yeah. Okay.
But the median per filer is less because, see, we get all what we call zeros. You get all the people that somebody else claims them as a dependent. What we've done with the OTIM analysis is try to break it out by household. And those raw numbers are in that in the intro part of your basic tax.
My point here is that if that dip there that is a significant piece of that chart also represents the income level of a very large, or the situation of a very large number of Oregonians.
Yes. Yes, that's true.
So that dip is more significant to an average taxpayer than it is to the, would appear in that chart,
yes.
I guess my point.
Yes. We have, and this is universal for all income analysis, we have a hard time with this group at the low end. Because they, we use different data sources. One of the things we use is Consumer Expenditure Survey. And this group always spends more than their income. And, of course, you think, well, how can they do that? Well, you know, there's a number of theories for why that is. They probably receive income from parents or some relatives or something, or other sources, and maybe illegal income. And there could be a whole series of things that influence that. But this data is always interesting, and that's one of the reasons why you see with a consumption tax, these folks really get hit hard, because they have higher consumption than their income. So if you tax general consumption, they really have a higher effective tax rate. So if you look at a Washington or another sales tax state, you tend to see a much more regressive system than what we have.
But Paul, and you pointed this out a little bit, that to the extent that they're spending more than they're earning is at least under some models reflected by the fact that there's a fair amount of income that isn't being reported as income at that level. And one thing a consumption tax does do is it forces taxation on income that otherwise currently isn't being reported on as income tax.
Correct. Yes. Now I'd like to kind of shift the focus to what's happened in terms of the state's revenue sources over the last 10 years, and I'm sure that you've seen the numbers and heard a lot of discussion about, the general fund has grown rapidly in the 90s, and it certainly did, as we saw from those income tax numbers. This gives you a comparison of general fund resources. Now, I use the term resources versus revenue, and I'm going to come back to that because I think it's very important for you as you look ahead to 0305. Resources is revenue plus beginning balance. So that's the difference, and you'll see that when you come through a tough period where revenue is coming in under projections, like you've gone through this biennium, it really affects the resources for next biennium because you don't have a beginning balance. But if you look at this chart, here's personal income, which grew rapidly in the 1990s. You can see it grew about 80%, around 8% a year. But you can see that general fund revenue grew about 112%. This is the so-called elasticity here shows up with these numbers of faster growth in revenue than in income. And that's what we've seen happen here in this period. If you look at the all funds revenue, I also have in your packet, I've got a budget page there that has general fund expenditures and revenue and all funds expenditures and revenue over the last 10 years. And that grew a little bit, I believe it was about 83%, a little bit more than personal income. So the all funds budget didn't grow as fast percentage-wise as the general fund, and that's because the all funds has a whole series of things that are unrelated to income and not nearly as elastic. You can see inflation was relatively low at about 30%, and here's population growth about to 18% for the decade, with a lot slower rate occurring in the second half. Capital gains, we've talked about. This is really the story of revenue in the 90s was this unprecedented jump in capital gains revenue, hanging in around $1 billion or so in the early 90s, moving up to about $2 billion here, and then really taking off all the way up to $6 billion. Personal income, by the way, in the States, about $100 billion. So this got up to around 6% of the total. But it also got up to about 11% of general fund revenue. Because most all of this is coming in at 9%. So it has a 9% marginal rate. All of it is in the top bracket.
Paul, other than just straight wages type income, I mean, is there any other category of income or of general fund support that got as large as this? I mean, there's nothing else that funds the general fund that got bigger than capital gains as a category, is that right?
Well, wages and salaries are about 60%
right
of the base, and this got up to around 11%. Interest and dividends are a pretty big component. And that has dropped off quite a bit as well. But I've got all of those numbers. I'll get you a chart on that. It shows not only what those numbers are, shows you what they are for the 01 returns that have come in and how much they've fallen. I do have a chart that looks at that a little bit, but I also have the detail for you. I'll get that for the committee. One of the things that I did to try to get a sense of the magnitude of the capital gains of the stock market bubble was to try to calculate some average. What would you expect capital gains to be? So I took the 1980s, which were a good time for the stock market. I mean, remember the kind of the beginning of the bull market was 1982, and said let's use that as a average, long-term average as a percent of income. So I said that's the average, and let's look at the 90s and how that compares with the long-term average. And these are the numbers. Now these are revenue numbers. So you can see that by 1999-01, the amount of revenue collections due to stock market gains above the average amounted to $670 million. Okay. And that, of course,
is what is now gone in one biennium. So, and you can see how this was fueling that general fund growth out here. But it was not, it was fueling it on a short-term basis. Also, corporate profits jumped. And, you know, corporate, it was another thing that you know, I mean, I remember just looking at corporate revenue projections and just basically flatlining them because they just weren't growing. In fact, if you look at the 79-80 and thinking about the chart I referred to in response to Representative Farr's question, that if you look at 79-80 corporate income tax collections, were not exceeded again until 92-93. So we went 15 years before we were back above that 79-80 level. And who knows, we may have a similar situation here. But this is where we got, you look at the jump here going from 300 all the way up to about 700 in this period. And again, it's a relatively small number of very profitable companies. And of course, the most profitable company in this period, and they did during this period release publicly some of their tax collections, was Intel. An extremely profitable decade. And of course, that generated a lot of revenue for the state.
Paul, if at any point, either now or later on, will you connect this kind of growth to government growth at all?
I do have the budget growth in there, and I don't have expenditure growth in here. I actually do in some of my other presentations, but I don't have it on this one. This is focusing on the revenue side. But I do have those numbers, and I can certainly go through those.
Yeah. Representative Scott.
What's the growth factor in corporations in that same period of time?
The number of corporations?
Percentage or numbers, whichever one.
We have a very large number of corporations that are filed as corporations. The majority of them pay no tax.
Yeah, excluding S's and LLCs. And what's the percentage growth of that 0.5% of income? What's the growth factor in that 10-year? Do you know that?
I don't know what that is. I don't think it would be real large, but we've got that number. We can take a look at it. Because mostly, again, it's these relatively small number of companies whose profits jump during that period. And, of course, nationally we saw a jump, too, in corporate profits. And that was one of the factors that fueled the stock market growth. So this is very much hand-in-hand with that financial market jump.
Yes.
Isn't it true that if you got a peek at four or five corporate tax returns, you'd know pretty much what you were going to get in that figure?
The four or five largest?
Yeah, the big ones.
Yeah, they do move around some. I mean, because they're on different cycles and different cyclical patterns. But there are four or five that could explain a large.
But they're so big that they drive this number pretty much.
Yes. This certainly has been the case over the last decade. But also keep in mind, you can be a big company with a lot of employees and not pay any corporate income tax because you're not profitable.
Well, but then they're still driving the number, in this case, down.
Well, that could be the case, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now for our kind of a review of our current situation, what I call the revenue crunch here. I don't have a lot on the economic numbers here, but if you look at them, nowhere nearly as severe a recession as we had in the early 80s. By historical standards, a relatively mild recession. Oregon has been hit harder than other states. Our unemployment, as we know, has been the highest in the country. Our job losses were among the highest on a year-over-year basis. We had the highest back a year ago last fall. So we have still a relatively mild recession, but a very sharp drop in general fund revenue. And so that raises this issue, I think, about the longer-term issue of stability is, why do we have this disconnect between our revenue falling so much in percentage terms, but our economy down, but not nearly down as much in percentage terms? This is the economic numbers. This is from your forecast, and the state economists will be going through some of this with you in a a couple of weeks. But you can see, here's the job losses. You can see the recession here in red. Here's the 1991 recession, which was a little bit milder. This was very much offset by the California in-migration, which peaked during that time and really softened the effect of this recession. But look at the early 80s. The early 80s were there's really no comparison here. Early 80s, we lost 10% of our jobs. We began to experience net out-migration because there weren't jobs here. So our housing starts during that period went from over 30,000 to 7,000 in 2 years. So the economy really was in its worst shape. It had been worst recession in Oregon since 37, 38. Now we're looking at a relatively mild recession, but now look at 01, 02 revenue. Our last full year, our general fund revenue declined 17%. This is not inflation adjusted. This is raw dollars dropped 17%.
Paul, if I could ask you something about the comparison of those recessions. Because the 1980s was such a severe recession, and yet the impact on the government's budget might have been less of a crisis than we are seeing today with a mild recession. That's why I wonder if we can compare something about the growth of services on this side. And
In terms of the reduction in expenditures.
Yes.
Well, the things to keep in mind about the expenditure side is that there's a lag between when our expenditures catch up with our revenue reductions. And this has to do with our use of our beginning balance, and it has to do with the fact that during your special sessions, there are a number of steps taken to try to sustain expenditures through one-time revenues. And so, in a sense, we haven't seen the full expenditure impact. And that's where, you know, if you look at the governor's 03-05 budget, then you can get a better sense of what that looks like, because that assumes no additional revenue, just the basic revenue forecast. This was put together by Office of Economic Analysis, and I think this gets at Representative Williams' point about the components of income. You can see the wages and salaries, which are the largest component here, of the $910 million in lost revenue that occurred in that year. Only $81 million of it is from wages, which are by far the biggest component. So wages did drop. Wages were expected to grow marginally during the period, but they ended up being $81 million short of what they were the prior year. Capital gains are about $231 million of the drop from the prior year. This other income, which is largely dividend and business-type income, proprietor income, subchapter S income that shows up here, is a big chunk of this as well. But there are also some things that were the result of policy. Pension refund, we paid a final round of a pension refund that fiscal year, and we also had kicker refunds that went out. So that's $357 million of it. The corporate tax, which is only about 7% of the general fund, is a huge chunk of this. About a third of this drop was the $177.8 million. Interest earnings, and then this other general fund revenue increase. This was mostly tobacco settlement money that was put in the general fund so that we would have an ending balance at the time of the end of the regular session. $99 million of that is tobacco settlement. So you can see all these components are down, but they're all down, but it's really the capital gains and business and corporate that are the biggest reasons for the drop-off. There are business income, investment income that have driven it down. Not so much wages, and that's why, you know, you don't see the kind of job losses, the kind of economic damage from the early 80s, but it's really this business income. And it is a different kind of social issue when you're, you know, if you're a business making $400,000 a year and your income drops to $200,000, well, you're not on the street. But your taxes go down by a significant amount. And that's what's happened with the income tax. The income tax is picking up is very sensitive to changes in these components because it's picking up 9% of them in those cases.
So Paul, if I could, speaking from the area of the state that I represent in Washington County, what this means is while some of those folks out at Intel and those high-tech companies lost their jobs, the majority of them are still keeping their jobs and earning their base wages, but what they're not getting is that supercharged effect of all those bonuses, stock option kind of income that was fueling us for a lot of that part of the mid to late 90s that supercharged essentially our general fund revenue system.
That's correct, yes. It's not the laid off timber workers that it was in the early 80s.
And there was mention a few, this just is a continuation of Representative Williams' thought. If there are only about five major players, and I'm just picking five, but we know there's a small number of big players in this corporate income tax thing, and they are also big employers, and if those employees had in their portfolios a lot of stock from those particular companies, the capital gains thing would then be magnified further.
Yes.
For our state.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. But, you know, you can also think of some definitely worse, even worse conditions. The one thing that's really held up here, and is the real estate markets. I mean, that was one of the key differences between now and the early 80s. And may these people may not be buying as much property in Sun River, but we do continue to see a pretty strong real estate market in Oregon because of the low interest rate environment we've had. Mm. And that's the biggest difference with the early 80s.
Your point being that it could be worse.
Could be worse. It's also the point being that in a percentage basis, not only measure 50, but governments have not been hit nearly as hard because they've been able to, their property tax dollars have been relatively flat, but they haven't seen the kind of percentage drops that we've seen at the state level. Of course, they didn't have the gains that we had in the 90s either. Mm-hmm.
For counties, however, that have delved into other things like a business income tax,
that's true.
They are starting to experience those some of the very same impacts. Isn't that
That's
accurate?
Correct. Absolutely, yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
In the television news business, whenever we went to a story that didn't pan out, we always had to make something of it, and we'd always end by saying, well, this could have been much worse. I was just wondering if you could just ballpark a different scenario for this recession and say instead of a 9% income tax, it was maybe a 5% income tax, but there was a consumption tax in place, and how that would have affected the dramatic drop in revenues?
Representative Hass, we have looked at that and kind of toyed with it, particularly in terms of a general consumption tax or value-added gross receipts type tax. The percentage drop would have clearly been less than what we've seen. We definitely would have felt the recession would have been significant. I mean, look at Washington. Washington is a pure consumption tax system, and they have obviously been hit hard by it. But the percentage drops would not have been nearly as much. We wouldn't see anything near the 17% drop we saw last fiscal year, the 8% we're expecting for the biennium. We probably would have been maybe down, say, 2 to 3% instead of the 8% that we were expecting then.
I have to follow up on that, Paul. Give us a little history, though, of the 9 times that it's been voted down by the voters, and what has been an analysis of that? Is it that they fear government would continue to raise it? Has there been any thought on why it has been turned down by Oregonians for so many times?
Well, the consumption tax, if you look at major taxes among the states, you don't see the introduction of a major tax very often. The last time we've had a major sales tax, I believe, was in the 60s. So, you know, we've tended to have kind of historical periods where they occurred. And most of the sales taxes we see now were introduced in the 30s, during the revenue shortfalls and the budget crisis. Of course, they were big crises. Back to it, could have been worse. It was clearly worse then. And a number of states did adopt sales taxes. A number of them adopted income taxes around that time. Of course, Oregon did in 1929. So it doesn't happen very often. There are huge forces for inertia for any major new tax. And I think you couple that with the fact that Oregon has a very strong initiative system, very strong voter approval system, referendum system, that makes any kind of major new tax very difficult. You've got a lot of explanation to do. It doesn't matter, I think, what the general attitude of the public is. There's a lot of uncertainty when you introduce a change like that, and there are going to be people that are going to be adversely affected. A lot of people just don't like the uncertainty of it. So, you know, I think it's problematic at any time for in any state, and then you throw in Oregon's strong initiative and referendum process, makes it very difficult. So I don't know if it's a sales tax per se, or if it's just that a major tax of any type would have a difficult time. So that would be my analysis.
Okay. Thank you.
This is the current projection on revenue, and you can see that, again, these are just in dollar terms. It's a dropping from the prior biennium. You see the rapid growth here, and dropping from the prior biennium by 8.4%. Again, this is resources that would include the beginning balance. Corporate revenue, this is just taking that last chart you saw and showing the 0103 current projection, and here's the level down to about $395 million. So getting back down to where we were in 91-93, you're getting pretty close to it. So the issue here is this just a blip, and we're going to be down to this level, or are we going to grow back to that level? I think what we've seen in the forecast process is a growing assumption that we may be down here for a while. I think this gets a little bit at Representative Hass's question about the kind of the how a consumption-based system would perform. This is corporate sales and personal income taxes for all the states, and it looks at year over year. This is getting a little bit too busy, but looking at a year over year basis, percentage change, and you go back to the first quarter of 01. And this is the time when, of course, the current budget forecast is being developed. And you can see that, well, there's a sign that things are starting to deteriorate. Look at corporate. It's down almost 10% on a year-over-year basis. But look at personal. It was up 10%. That was really the last round of those capital gains because it's based on the 2000 tax year. So here it is, up about 8% on personal for 2001 second quarter. But by the time, and this is when the forecast was developed for your budget, and then we go, the regular session ends, we get our first forecast is looking at personals dropping nationally along with Oregon, and look at the year-over-year drops, got up over 20% when we look at the second quarter of 02, where the returns were coming in from 01 with no capital gains on. Our capital gain revenue dropped 54%. Nationally, total personal income dropped 22%, personal income tax. So, and now if you look at kind of a recovery developing here, the total is actually up now, but personal is still down year over year. You contrast that with sales taxes. Sales taxes in blue here have stayed positive throughout this period. One small negative here. Now, there's two reasons for that. One is, long-term, sales taxes are more stable. Now, sometimes the base can affect that. Depends on what you're taxing. If you exempt food and other kind of stable components, you can create a more unstable sales tax. A sales tax in general is more stable than an income tax. It has only one rate. Everything's taxed at 5% or 6%. It's not taxed at different marginal rates as the income tax is. And people tend to cut consumption less in percentage terms than they cut than their income falls. They take some out of savings. So that's kind of the theoretical reason. But what happened in this current recession, it's not officially over yet, It's back to what I said about interest rates. Housing market, auto market held up very well. Well, we don't tax housing purchases. Sales tax states don't tax housing purchases. They tax appliances, they tax furniture, all the things that are very strongly correlated with new home purchases. So that's been a that's helped the sales tax states hold up in this particular recession. So that's one of the reasons you see the sharp. And of course, the other reason here on the income tax is the capital gains piece, which we suspect won't recur. We won't see that kind of a wild swing again.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Paul, on this slide and on the previous slide, you've shown a level of optimism regarding the direction of the economy. I'm assuming that farther down in the presentation you'll explain the justification for your optimism.
Yes, Paul, I'll also show you what the current forecast is, and we can talk some about the risks as well.
And as I recall, a similar sort of optimism prevailed at the beginning of this biennium, which, of course...
Well, the at the beginning of this biennium, the forecast was generally flat. You know, no recession, but a weak economy. Well, we were actually in recession at the time and didn't know it, and that's very typical for all recessions. So, yes, there was the optimism in the sense that we would avoid a recession, that things would be flat rather than down. But there was no expectation that growth would continue as it had before.
Thank you, Paul.
Of course, you know, you look at those numbers in the context of those national numbers, and you see income tax falling and sales tax holding up pretty well. Well, you look at Oregon, and of course, we are the most income tax dependent state in the nation. About 3/4 of our state tax collections come from the personal income tax. The second most dependent on any single source is Washington, the sales tax at 64%. Alaska's other here is predominantly severance tax, oil and gas severance tax. They haven't done the statistical analysis of this, but I would feel comfortable in saying they have the most volatile revenue system because it's been oil and gas. I've got a former classmate of mine does the forecasting for them, and I don't envy him. These are the budget actions that were taken. Again, if you look at the expenditure versus the revenue side of things, the expenditure side has not caught up yet. And that's what you're looking at in your 2003-05 budget. About 919 in reductions, including rebalance from increased caseloads. About 310 million of that is Measure 28. Or is House Bill 5100, but it is restored if Measure 28 passes. This is our accounting adjustment, which was a one-time adjustment. One-time revenues include things like the new education stability funds, $150 million. So those dollars are not there next time as you look ahead for your planning in 2003-05. Temporary revenue here, this is primarily the phase-in of Measure 88. Which did have some positive effects in the next biennium, but didn't affect the permanent revenue base because we will go to the subtraction limit that was called for under Measure 88. The only real permanent revenue here is a cigarette tax increase, Measure 20. This deficit has been eliminated through the governor's administrative actions, reducing the budget by $112 million. Through across-the-board reductions that Governor Kitzhaber put in place, established the rule just before he left office. So now if we look at 2003-05 and the aftermath, the economic outlook, excuse me, how our revenue will respond to that, and then keeping in mind on the expenditure side that, again, where our expenditure side is lagging the adjustments on the revenue side. And you see that on the upside, too. Your expenditures don't keep up with your revenue. Revenue's coming in faster than expenditures because you've got to, it ends up accumulating in the ending balance, and then you can spend it next biennium. Now we've got the opposite occurring. This is the December economic and revenue forecast. Here's the effect of the recession here in terms of job growth. Expectation is we'll come back in 2003. Growth rate, This looks fairly steep, but still, this is a growth rate of a little over 2%, well below what we were seeing in our previous expansions in the late 80s and in the mid 90s. The expectation here is the thing that will the single most important thing for getting Oregon's economy back into positive growth would be a return at the national level of business investment spending. We are a capital goods oriented state. We are dependent on business investment spending, which nowadays means largely information technology equipment, but also means things like heavy trucks that have been a major factor in our growth, and transportation equipment. So that would be the key factor that would generate growth. The expectation is inventories are down. We've had basically 2 years of very little business investment spending, that its businesses will begin to pick up replacement spending and begin to try to upgrade and improve their information technology. Not nearly the boom we saw in the mid-90s, but begin to turn positive. Some other factors here that should come into play as we expect the world economy to begin to improve, therefore exports to begin to pick up. Oregon is an export-sensitive state. So that, along with recovery in our other markets like California and Canada, as well as Asia, should begin to stimulate demand for our products. So that's the normal cyclical pattern, and that's the underlying assumption here.
Yes.
Well, quick question. Have you seen any evidence nationally that the federal stimulus laws have done anything to stimulate the economy? Is it too early to tell?
I
accelerate depreciation.
I think you can make the case that the recession is more shallow, was more shallow, because of federal stimulus. Certainly the consumption side of things, through the general rate reductions and income taxes, and of course the other factor that's been huge has been monetary policy through pushing interest rates so low. Those two factors, I think, have made this a shallow recession. In terms of things like the bonus depreciation and trying to stimulate actual business investment spending, we haven't seen much effect at this stage, and that's what we're waiting for. That's what will get the national economy moving, and in Oregon in particular. We do see some kind of spotty evidence continually that manufacturing is starting to take off. Some good evidence from December that we're starting to see some strength. Yet the employment numbers were very weak in December nationally, and really almost recession-level employment numbers again. So that was kind of a disappointment. Oregon's numbers, though, on jobs, if you look year over year, have consistently improved. So we're now at the point where we are seeing some increase on a year-over-year basis for the first time in a year and a half. So we are starting to recover here. We're just not seeing a lot of job growth.
Paul, with the looming possibility of a military action in Iraq, can you just give us just briefly, sort of from your old state economist days, what you would anticipate the impact of that would be if that caused an energy price increase, both for the national economy and how that has an echo effect in Oregon?
Well, I do recall Representative Williams when very vividly the fall of 1990 when we had Measure 5 passed, but we also had 500,000 U.S. troops building up in the Middle East for another conflict with Iraq. And at that time, we assumed that there would be an extended period of high oil prices, because we thought there would be an extended military conflict there, and which we would see oil prices up around $40 a barrel. We undershot on the forecast, and particularly on the corporate side, because what happened was once the conflict began, it was almost the next day, oil prices dropped to $10 to $20 a barrel and stayed there. So we still had a recession because consumers were affected through consumer confidence and uncertainty, but we didn't see the energy price effect we thought we would. So
we owe our kicker during that period of time to the war in Iraq because you undershot the forecast. Is that what happened?
Actually, we didn't get it. We did not get a kicker that biennium because I had raised the forecast between the governor's budget and the legislatively approved budget because we could see that the energy prices weren't going to go up. The war was already over. And so, but the kicker really was due more to those capital gains.
In terms of the energy prices, yeah, if we get a sustained uncertainty, a sustained military conflict there, oil prices are going to go up. And there's little doubt about that. But I think once that conflict has been determined, we'll see it drop back down again, because there's been a huge reserves of oil that has been constrained because of the Iraqi political situation. So it potentially could be a positive out there, but I think until it's resolved, we're going to see upward pressure on oil prices. If things start to deteriorate and we see some actual shooting going on and destruction of facilities and so forth, then I think we'll see a bump up. And it does raise the risk of a double dip. I think it increases the risk of that happening.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I hate to beat this horse that is all speculative anyway, but isn't it also true that warfare has changed? There's a huge technological component. I hate to look at the bright side of this war. And it's very possible that manufacturing in high tech would be encouraged by this kind of a war. We think of World War II, big heavy tanks going out. This is not modern warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And so there might be something that says that a war in Iraq would help our high-tech industry, manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's possible. Traditionally, we have not seen much impact from defense buildup. We do know, regardless of how this conflict unfolds, we do know that there is a long-term commitment on the part of the administration, and I think policymakers in general, to increase the defense budget. And we're seeing that happen. That has not helped Oregon. It may change a little bit with high tech, but, for example, in the 80s, we received very little benefit from that buildup at that time. And if we get the annual data from the federal government on dollars per state, per capita, and the categories. And on procurement, we consistently rank right out. That's predominantly defense. So we're not getting a big kick there. California will. Washington will. But we have not picked up much from that impact. This is the revenue forecast that's associated with it, and this is, I think, the number for you to keep in mind here. If you look at the blue number here, what Office of Economic Analysis does is they make an adjustment for the kicker, so you can see kind of the underlying growth out there. Here's the 7% drop that would have occurred even without the kicker and the pension refunds. 13.6, basically what they're assuming for the governor's budget, is that we get a return to about trend growth. There's trend growth here in the late 90s. So we're going to get a return to trend growth under that assumption. If it's like 8 or 9% for the biennium, then we're going to have less revenue. So keep in mind, this is an average growth rate. Certainly nothing like we saw back here in 95-97, where 22% growth with about 6% inflation. It's expected to partially bounce back, but one of the things that can give you kind of a sense of what's happening on the revenue side is that to take this 99.01 level, which is what we were budgeted at, and really the 0103 was based on a continuation of that level, take this bar and grow it 6%, and you get what I call trend here. Okay, so this is what revenue would be if the 99.01 would have grown 6% a year and stayed on its long-term trend. This is the current projection. Again, this is resources. This is the current projection here with a 13.5% return to trend. But notice the difference between the two bars is about almost $2 billion. So, another way of looking at it, back to Representative Verger's question on the expenditure side, essentially what's happened on the expenditure side is you have a level of expenditures that are based on this 99.01 level, and you apply cost to that 5-6% a year, then you end up more at this bar rather than at this bar. And that's the difference you have.
Of course, there's all kinds of factors involved there, the PERS costs, medical costs, Medicaid, and so forth. Some are growing faster than 5%, some less. And finally, my last slide here, again, is getting at kind of another revenue side of what you're dealing with in 03-05. And that is, you look at the jump, here we go from resources, here's your beginning balance going into 97-99. Remember, the kicker never affects the beginning balance. If you get more revenue, that just accumulates in the beginning balance. It affects revenue stream next biennium when the refund's sent out. But here's a huge beginning balance from the 95-97, that 22% growth we just saw. $800 million going into the biennium. So the legislature in the 97 session had $800 million in the bank before they started 97-99. Now, you can see the numbers drop a little bit here, down to $338 million going into 99-01. Still $363 going into this biennium we had in the bank. Okay. Now, revenues have come in short. Here's revenue dropping, as we see here. This is our 8% drop. And now we look at our resources that are down below what they were the prior biennium. And we come into the next 03-05 period. Here we've got a jump in resources, or in revenue. This is the 17% growth rate assumed, 13.5% when you adjust for the kicker, lowering this number. So, but look at the beginning balance. So now, your resources, you compare these two numbers, this 99-01 number here, with what we're expecting in 03-05, there's about a 4% difference. So a 4% increase in resources over a four-year period.
And Paul, that again assumes that plug number of 13.6%.
Yes.
Right. And if we're off on, if that number's wrong in the governor's proposed budget, if we come in at 10 or 9.5, we add that additional 4, so we're 8% off.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we added to tell us how much the difference is. Right? Mm-hmm.
So that can begin to give you a sense. And, of course, these numbers here, these beginning balance numbers, were always unexpected. I mean, that's big revenue was coming in hot. So one of the key decisions you'll have to make as a body when you develop the 03-05 budget is what kind of projected ending balance are you going to leave. And that becomes a huge issue when you look at these revenue numbers and the uncertainty.
Paul, if one of the key factors, though, for the future is this pent-up lack of replacement or need of replacement in business and business activity being where it is, how does Oregon help entice business investment and be more competitive? In the last 10 years of working trying to get businesses to locate here, we've been outbid. In other words, there are other states that have more attractive things. And so I agree with you that when times are hard, business, so that people go and they don't buy. But at some point, you have to go forward. And we need to be there. Mm-hmm. But what do we need to do to change that?
Madam Chair, I think, the states can do a lot, I think, to influence their economic growth. I do think it's more of a long-term proposition. We're not really equipped to deal with the business cycle. I mean, we kind of have to rely on the federal government to do that in terms of anti-recession policy. But in terms of the decisions you make, I think have significant effects over the next decade. I think you have to recognize that most businesses are going to look at state government as a package. You know, what kind of services am I getting? What's the education quality? What's the infrastructure versus what are the costs to me as a business in terms of taxes, regulatory restrictions, and so forth? So they're looking at that package. And I think what the state needs to do is make that package as attractive as possible for capital development. I mean, I think you need to look at it beyond simply just business, but to look at it as to make it a state in which the returns to capital, and to labor are competitive and more attractive than the neighboring areas that we compete with. And that again becomes looking at that overall package.
So. Are there other comments or questions of Paul? Well, if not, I remind you that we do not have a meeting tomorrow. And then next week we will be taking personal taxes, excise, school finance, and revenue options. So we'll look forward to those. And, Paul, thank you so very much for an enlightening and educational PowerPoint presentation. And I'll call the meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
Good.